would have countenanced. He arranged for a peace treaty with the Amoyeti Spectrum Helix armies, in which his Pax forces would enter the countryside only with the permission of the indigenes. In return, Pax base Bombacino was allowed to continue its existence. Solznikov, Colonel Venara, and the other loyal Christians settled in to wait for Vatican and Pax fleet retribution. But the Anea Change civilians were among the Spectrum Helix people who came to market at Bombacino, who met and ate and drank with the troopers, who moved among the dispirited Pax men and women and told their story, and who offered their communion. Many accepted. This, of course, was the tiniest slice of events on the hundreds of worlds of the Pax that last sad night I would ever spend on Tian Shan. I did not guess any of these events, of course, but if I had already mastered the skill and discipline of learning these things via the void which binds, I still would not have cared. Anea had loved another man. They had been married. She must still be married. She had not mentioned divorce or death. She had had a child. I do not know why my carelessness did not send me falling to my death those wild hours on the icy ridge east of Zhou Kong and Swan Kung Su, but it did not. Eventually I came to my senses and returned via the ridgeline and the fixed rappelling ropes so that I could be back with Anea by first light. I loved her. She was my dear friend. I would give my life to protect her. An opportunity to prove that would be offered within the day, its inevitability created by the events that unfolded shortly after my return to the temple hanging in air, and our departure to the east. It was not that long after first light, and the old Gompa beneath the phallus Shiva now turned into Christian enclave, where John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa, Admiral Margaret Wu, Father Farrell, Archbishop Breck, Father LeBlanc, Radamanth Nemes, and her two remaining siblings met in conference. In truth, it was the humans who met in conference, while Nemes and her clone sister and brother sat silently by the window, looking out over the billowing cloudscapes around Otter Lake, below the Shivling Peak. "And you are certain that the rogue ship Raphael is finished?" the Grand Inquisitor was saying. "Absolutely," said Admiral Wu, "although it destroyed 7 of our Archangel ships of the line before we slacked it." She shook her head. "Desoya was a brilliant tactician. It was the true work of the Evil One when he turned apostate." Father Farrell leaned over the polished bonsai wood table. "And there is no chance that Desoya or any of the others survived?" Admiral Wu shrugged. "It was a near-orbit battle," she said. "We let Raphael get within cislunar distance before springing our trap. Thousands of pieces of debris, mostly from our unfortunate ships, entered the atmosphere. None of our people appeared to have survived. At least no beacons had been detected. If any of Desoya's people escaped, the chances are that their pods came down in the poisonous oceans."
"Still,"
began Archbishop Breck. He was a quiet man, cerebral and cautious. Wu looked exhausted and irritated. "Your Eminence," she said briskly, addressing Breck but looking at Mustafa. "We can decide the issue one way or the other if you allow us to send dropships, skimmers, and EMVs into the atmosphere." Breck blinked. Cardinal Mustafa shook his head. "No," he said. "Our orders are not to show a military presence until the Vatican commands the final step in our seizure of the girl." Wu smiled with apparent bitterness. "Last night's battle just above the atmosphere must have made that order somewhat obsolete," she said softly. "Our military presence must have been rather impressive."
"It was," said Father LeBlanc. "I have never seen anything like it."
Admiral Wu spoke to Mustafa.
"Your Excellency, the people on this world have no energy weapons, no Hawking drive detectors, no orbital defenses, no gravitonic detectors. Hell, they don't have radar or a communication system as far as we can tell. We can send dropships or fighter aircraft into the atmosphere to search for survivors without them ever knowing. It has to be a lot less intrusive than last night's firefight and—"
"No," said Cardinal Mustafa.
and there was no doubting the finality of his decision. The Grand Inquisitor pushed back his robe to glance at his chronometer.
The Vatican courier drone should arrive any moment with final orders for the arrest of the contagion vector named Anea. Nothing must complicate that.
Father Farrell rubbed his lean cheeks.
Regent Tok'ra called me this morning on the communicator channel we allocated him. It seems that their precious and precocious little Dalai Lama has gone missing.
Breck and LeBlanc looked up in surprise.
It doesn't matter, said Cardinal Mustafa, obviously aware of the news. Nothing matters right now except receiving final go-ahead on this mission and arresting Anea.
He looked at Admiral Wu.
And you must tell your Swiss Guard and Marine officers that no harm can come to the young woman.
Wu nodded wearily. She had been briefed and rebriefed for months.
When do you think that the orders will come? She asked the Cardinal.
Radamanth Nemes and her two siblings stood and walked toward the door.
The time for waiting is over, said Nemes with a thin-lipped smile. We will bring Anea's head back to you.
Cardinal Mustafa and the others were on their feet in an instant.
Sit down, bellowed the Grand Inquisitor. You have not been ordered to move.
Nemes smiled and turned toward the door. All of the clerics in the room were shouting. Archbishop Jean-Daniel Breck crossed himself. Admiral Wu went for the flechette pistol in her holster. Things then happened too quickly to perceive. The air seemed to blur. One instant, Nemes, Scylla, and Briareus were at the doorway 8 meters away. The next instant, they were gone and three shimmering chrome shapes stood among the black and red-robed figures at the table. Scylla intercepted Admiral Margit Wu before the woman could raise her flechette pistol. A chrome arm blurred. Wu's head tumbled across the polished tabletop. The headless body stood a few seconds. Some random nerve impulse ordered the fingers of the right hand to close, and the flechette pistol fired, blowing apart the legs of the heavy table and splintering the stone floor in 10,000 places. Father LeBlanc leaped between Briareus and Archbishop Breck. The blurred silver shape disemboweled LeBlanc. Breck dropped his glasses and ran into the adjoining room. Suddenly, Briareus was gone, leaving nothing but a soft implosion of air where the blurred shape had stood a second before. There was a short scream from the other room, cut off almost before it began. Cardinal Mustafa backed away from Radamanth Nemes. She took one step forward for every step he took backward. The blurred field around her had dropped away, but she looked no more human or less menacing.
"Damn you for the foul thing you are!" the Cardinal said softly. Come ahead, I'm not afraid to die.
Nemes raised one eyebrow.
Of course not, Your Excellency. But would it change your mind if I tell you that we're throwing these bodies? And that head?
She gestured to where Margit Wu's eyes had just stopped blinking and now stared blindly.
Far out into the acid ocean, so that no resurrection will be possible?
Cardinal Mustafa reached the wall and stopped. Nemes was only 2 paces in front of him.
Why are you doing this?
He said, his voice firm. Nemes shrugged.
Our priorities diverge for the time being, she said. Are you ready, Grand Inquisitor?
Cardinal Mustafa crossed himself and said a hurried act of contrition.
Nemes smiled again. Her right arm and right leg became shimmering silver things, and she stepped forward.
Mustafa watched in amazement. She did not kill him. With motions too quick to detect, she broke his left arm, shattered his right arm, kicked his legs out from under him, splintering both of them, and blinded him with 2 fingers that stopped just short of jabbing into his brain. The roar of pain was without precedent for the Grand Inquisitor. Through it, he could hear her voice, still flat and lifeless.
I know your doc in the box in the dropship or on the Jibreel will fix you up, she said. We've buzzed them. They'll be here in a few minutes. When you see the Pope and his parasites, tell them that those to whom I must report did not want the girl alive. Our apologies, but her death is necessary. and tell them to be careful in the future, not to act without the consent of all elements of the Corps. Goodbye, Your Excellency. I hope that the dock on the Jibreel can grow you new eyes. What we are about to do will be worth seeing.
Mustafa heard footsteps, the door sliding and then silence, except for the sound of someone screaming in terrible pain. It took him several minutes to realize that it was he who was screaming. When I returned to the temple hanging in air, first light was seeping through the fog, but the morning remained dark, drizzly, and cold. I had finally sobered up enough from my distraught and distracted state to take greater care while rappelling down the fixed lines. And it was good that I had. Several times the brakes on the rappel gear slipped on the ice-shrouded rope, and I would have fallen to my death if the safety lines had not arrested me. Ania was awake, dressed, and ready to leave when I arrived. She had on her thermal anorak, climbing harness, and climbing boots. A. Betic and Lomo Dondrub were dressed similarly, and both men carried long, heavy-looking nylon-wrapped packages over their shoulders. They were going with us. Others were there to say goodbye. Theo, Rachel, the Dorji Famo, the Dalai Lama, George Sarong, Jigme Norbu. And they seemed sad and anxious. Ania looked tired. I was sure that she had not slept either. We made a tired-looking pair of adventurers. Lomo walked over and handed me one of the long nylon-wrapped bundles. It was heavy, but I shouldered it without question or complaint. I grabbed the rest of my own gear, answered Lomo's questions about the condition of the ropes to the ridgeline. Everyone evidently thought that I had unselfishly reconnoitered our route, and stepped back to look at my friend and beloved. When she gave me a searching look, I answered with a nod. "It's all right. I'm all right. I'm ready to go. We'll talk about it later." Theo was crying. I was aware that this was an important parting, that we might not see one another again, despite Ania's assurances to the other two women that everyone would be reunited before nightfall. But I was too emotionally numbed and worn out to react to it. I stepped away from the group for a moment to take deep breaths and focus my attention. It was probable that I would need all of my wits and alertness in the next few hours just to survive. The problem with being passionately in love, I thought, is that it deprives you of too much sleep. We left by the east platform, moved in a fast trot down the icy ledge toward the fissure, past the ropes I'd just descended, and reached the fissure without incident. The bonsai trees and fell fields looked ancient and unreal in the shifting ice fog, the dark limbs and branches dripping on our heads when they suddenly loomed out of the mist. The streams and waterfalls sounded louder than I remembered as the torrent slid over the last overhang into the void to our left. There were old, less reliable fixed ropes on the easternmost and highest folds of the fissure, and Lomo led the way up these, followed by Ania, then Abetic, and finally me. I noticed that our android friend was climbing as quickly and competently as he always did, despite the missing left hand. Once on the upper ridgeline, we were beyond my farthest point of my nighttime travels. The fissure acted as a barrier to ridgeline travel the way I had gone. Now the difficulty began in earnest as we followed the narrowest of paths, worn ledges, rock outcroppings, the occasional ice field, scree slopes, on the south side of the cliff face. The ridgeline above us was all serac of wet, heavy snow and icy overhang, impossible to travel on. We moved silently, not even whispering, aware that the slightest noise could trigger an avalanche that would sweep us off these 10-centimeter ledges in a second. Finally, when the going got even tougher, we roped up, running the line through carabiners and attaching a doubled line to our web-sling harnesses, so that now if one fell, he or she would be caught, or we would all go over. With Lomo leading as strongly as ever, stepping confidently over foggy voids and icy crevasses that I would hesitate to attempt, I think that we all felt better about being connected. I still did not know our destination. I did know that the great ridge that ran east from Kunlun past Zhou Kung would run out in a few more kilometers, dropping suddenly and dramatically into the poisonous clouds several clicks below. During certain weeks in the spring, the tides and vagaries of the ocean and clouds dropped the poisonous vapors low enough that the ridge emerged again, allowing supply caravans, pilgrims, monks, traders, and the simply curious to make their way east from the Middle Kingdom to Tai Shan, the great peak of the Middle Kingdom, and the most inaccessible habitable point on the planet. The monks who lived on Tai Shan, it was said, never returned to the Middle Kingdom or the rest of the mountains of heaven. For untold generations they had dedicated their lives to the mysterious tombs, gompas, ceremonies, and temples on that most holy of peaks. Now, as the weather worsened for us, I realized that if we started descending, we would not know when we left the roiling monsoon clouds and entered the roiling vaporous clouds until the poison air killed us. We did not descend. After several hours of all but silent travel, we reached the precipice at the eastern boundary of the Middle Kingdom. The mountain of Tai Shan was not visible, of course. Even with the clouds having cleared a bit, little was visible except for the wet cliff face ahead of us and the twisting fog and cloud patterns all around. There was a wide ledge here at the eastern edge of the world, and we sat on it gratefully as we dug cold hand meals out of our packs and drank from our water bottles. The tiny, succulent plants that carpeted this steep fell field were becoming tumescent as they gorged themselves on the first moisture of the monsoon months. After we ate and drank, Lomo and A. Betic began opening our three heavy bundles. Ania zipped open her own pack, which looked heavier than the duffels we men had carried. It did not surprise me what was wrapped in these three parcels. Nylon, alloy struts and frames, rigging, and in Ania's packet, more of the same, as well as the two skin suits and rebreathers that I'd brought with me from the ship and all but forgotten. I sighed and looked to the east. "So we're going to try to make Tai Shan," I said. "Yes," said Ania. She began stripping out of her clothes. A. Betic and Lomo looked away, but I felt my heart pound with anger at the thought of other men seeing my lover naked. I controlled myself, laid out the other skin suit, and began peeling out of my own clothes, folding them into my heavy pack as I doffed each layer. The air was cold and the fog clammy on my skin. Lomo and A. Betic were assembling the para-wings as Ania and I dressed. The skin suits were just that, almost literally a second skin. But the harness and rigging for the rebreathers allowed us some modesty. The cowl went over my head tighter than a scuba headpiece, folding my ears flat against my head. Only the filters there allowed sound to be transmitted. They would pick up the comm-thread transmissions once we were effectively out of real air. Lomo and A. Betic had reassembled four para-wings from the parts we had transported. As if answering my unasked question, Lomo said, "I can only show you the thermals and make sure you reach the jet stream. I can't survive at that altitude. And I do not want to go to Tai Shan when there is little chance of returning." Ania touched the powerful man's arm. "We are grateful beyond words that you will guide us to the jet stream." The bold flyer actually blushed. "What about A. Betic?" I asked, and then, realizing that I was talking about our friend as if he weren't there, I turned to the android and said, "What about you? There's no skin suit or rebreather for you." A. Betic smiled. I had always thought that his rare smiles were the wisest things I had ever seen on a human countenance, even if the blue-skinned man was not technically human. "You forget, Emendymion," he said. "I was designed to suffer a bit more abuse than the average human body." "But the distance," I began. Tai Shan was more than 100 kilometers east, and even if we reached the jet stream, that would be almost an hour of rarefied air, far too thin to breathe. A. Betic fastened the last rigging to his para-wing, a pretty thing with a great blue delta wingspan almost 10 meters across, and said, "If we are lucky enough to make the distance, I will survive it." I nodded, and made to get into the rigging of my own kite then, not asking any more questions, not looking at Ania, not asking her why the four of us were risking our lives this way, when suddenly my friend was at my elbow. "Thank you, Rol," she said, loudly enough for all to hear.
You do these things for me out of love and friendship. I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
I made some gesture, suddenly unable to speak, embarrassed that she was thanking me when the other two were ready to leap into the void for her as well. But she was not finished speaking.
I love you, Rol, said Aenea, leaning on her tiptoes to kiss me on the lips.
She rocked back and looked at me, her dark eyes fathomless.
I love you, Rol Endymion. I always have. I always will.
I stood, bewildered and overwhelmed, as we all locked into our power-wing rigs and stood at the ultimate edge of nothing. Loma was the last to clip on. He moved from Abetic to Aenea to me, checking our riggings, checking every fastened nut, bolt, tension clip, and insta-weld of our kites. Satisfied, he nodded respectfully toward Abetic, clipped into his own red-winged rig with a speed born of infinite practice and discipline, and moved to the edge of the cliff. Even the succulents did not grow in this last meter stretch, as if terrified of the drop. I knew that I was. The last rocky ledge was steeply pitched and slick from the rain. The fog had closed in again.
"It will be hard to see each other in this soup," said Lomo. "Keep circling to the left. Stay within 5 meters of the one in front of you. Same orders as our march. Aenea after me and your yellow wing, then the blue man in blue, then you, Rol, in the green. Our greatest risk is losing one another in the clouds."
Aenea nodded tersely. "I'll stay close to your wing."
Lomo looked at me.
"You and Aenea can communicate via your skin suit comm threads, but that will not help you find one another. Abetic and I will communicate via hand signals. Be careful. Do not lose sight of the blue man's kite. If you do, keep circling up counterclockwise until you clear the cloud tops and then try to regroup with us. Keep the circles tight while inside the clouds. If you loosen them, which is the tendency with parawings, you will strike the cliff."
My mouth was dry as I nodded.
"All right," said Lomo. "I will see you all above the clouds. Then I will find the thermals for you, read the ridge lift, and get you to the jet stream. I will signal like this." He made a fist and pumped his arm twice. "When I am leaving you, keep climbing and circling. Get as deeply into the stream as you can. Rise into the upper atmospheric winds until you think that they will tear your wing apart from above you. Perhaps they will, but you will have no chance to reach Taishan unless you get into the center of the stream. It is 111 clicks to the first shoulder of the great peak where you can breathe true air."
We all nodded.
"May the Buddha smile on our folly today," said Lomo.
He seemed very happy.
"Amen," said Aenea.
Lomo turned without another word and leaped out over the cliff's edge. Aenea followed a second later. Abetic leaned far forward in his harness, kicked off the ledge, and was swallowed up by clouds within seconds. I scurried to catch up. Suddenly, there was no stone under my feet, and I leaned forward until I was prone in the harness. Already I had lost sight of Abetic's blue wing. The swirling clouds confused and disoriented me. I pulled on the control bar, banking the hang glider as I had been taught, peering intently through the fog for a glimpse of any of the other kites. Nothing. Belatedly, I realized that I had held the turn for too long. Or had I released it too soon? I leveled off the wing, feeling thermals pushing at the fabric above me, but not being able to tell if I was actually gaining altitude because I was blind. The fog was like some terrible snow blindness. Without thinking, I shouted, hoping one of the others would shout back and orient me. A man's shout hurtled back to me from just a few meters dead ahead. It was my own voice, echoing off the vertical rock of the cliff face I was about to strike. Nemes, Scylla, and Briareus move south on foot from the Pax Enclave at the Phallus of Shiva. The sun is high, and there are thick clouds to the east. To travel from the Pax Enclave to the Winter Palace at Portala, the old highway southwest along the Kokonor Ridge had been repaired and widened, and a special cable platform had been built where the 10-click wire ran from Kokonor southwest to the palace.
A palanquin specially rigged for the Pact's diplomats now hangs from pulleys at the new platform. Nemes pushes to the front of the line and steps into it, ignoring the stares from the little people in thick chubas who mill on the stairway and platform. When her clone siblings are in the cage, she releases the two brakes and sends the palanquin hurtling across the gap. Dark clouds rise above the palace mountain. A squad of 20 palace guard carrying halberds and crude energy lances greets them at the great terrace steps on the west side of Yellow Hat Ridge, where the palace drops away down the east face for several vertical kilometers. The captain of the guard is deferential. "You must wait here until we bring an honor guard to escort you into the palace, most honored guests," he says, bowing.
"We prefer to go in alone," says Nemes.
The 20 guardsmen crouch, with lances at port arms. They make a solid wall of iron, zygote fur, silk, and elaborate helmets. The guard captain bows lower. "I apologize for my unworthiness, most honored guests, but it is not possible to enter the Winter Palace without an invitation and an honor guard. Both will be here in a minute. If you will be so kind as to wait in the shade under the pagoda roof here, honored guests, a personage of the proper rank to greet you will arrive in only a moment." Nemes nods. "Kill them," she says to Scylla and Briareus, and walks forward into the palace as her siblings' phase shift. They shift down during the long walk through the many-leveled palace, shifting into fast time only to kill guards and servants. When they exit by the main steps and approach the Pargo Kaling, the great western gate on this side of the Ki Chu Bridge, they find Regent Retting Tokra blocking the way with 500 of his finest palace guard troops. A few of these elite fighters carry swords and pikes, but most hold crossbows, slug rifles, crude energy weapons, and railguns.
"Commander Nemes," says Tokra,
lowering his head slightly, but not bowing so much as to lose eye contact with the woman in front of him.
"We have heard what you did at Sheevling. You can go no farther."
Tokra nods at someone high up in the gleaming eyes on the Pargo Kaling Tower, and the black chrome bridge of Ki Chu slides silently back into the mountain. Only the great suspension cables remain far above, ringed about with razor wire and frictionless gel. Nemes smiles.
"What are you doing, Tokra?"
"His Holiness has gone to Swan Kung Su," says the thin-faced regent. "I know why you travel that way. You cannot be allowed to harm His Holiness the Dalai Lama."
Radamanth Nemes shows more of her small teeth.
"What are you talking about, Tokra? You sold out your dear little boy god to the Pact Secret Service for 30 pieces of silver. Are we bartering here for more of your stupid six-sided coins?"
The regent shakes his head.
"The agreement with the Pax was that His Holiness would never be hurt, but you..."
"We want the girl's head," says Nemes, "not your boy Lama's. Get your men out of our way or lose them."
Regent Tokra turns and barks an order at his row upon row of soldiers. The men's faces are grim as they raise their weapons to their shoulders. The mass of them blocks the way to the bridge, even though the roadway of the bridge is no longer there. Dark clouds boil in the chasm.
"Kill them all," says Nemes, phase shifting.
Lomo had trained us all in the hang glider controls, but I had never had the opportunity to fly one before. Now, as the cliff rose out of the fog in front of me, I had to do the correct thing immediately, or die. The kite was controlled by manipulating the control bar that hung in front of me as I dangled in my harness, and I leaned as far left and put as much weight on it as the rigging allowed. The parawing banked, but not steeply enough, I realized at once. The kite was going to intercept the rock wall a meter or two away from the outer apex of its arc. There was another set of controls, handle grips that spilled air from the dorsal surface at the leading edge of each side of the dorsal wing. But these were dangerous and tricky and for emergency use only. I could see the lichen on the approaching rock wall. This was an emergency. I pulled hard on the left panic handle, The nylon on the left side of the para wing opened like a slit purse. The right wing, still catching the strong ridge lift here, banked up steeply. The para wing turned almost upside down, with its useless left wing spilling air like so much empty aluminum frame. My legs were flung out sideways as the kite threatened to stall and plummet into the rocks. My boots actually brushed stone and lichen, and then the wing was falling almost straight down. I released the left handle. The active memory fabric on the left leading surface healed itself in an instant, and I was flying again, although in a near vertical dive. The strong thermals rising along the cliff face struck the kite like a rising elevator, and I was slammed upward, the control bar swinging back against my upper chest, hard enough to knock the wind out of me. And the para-wing swooped, climbed, and tried to do a lazy loop with a radius of 60 or 70 meters. I found myself hanging almost upside down again, but this time with the kite and controls beneath me and the rock wall dead ahead again. This was no good. I would conclude the loop on the cliff wall. I yanked the right panic handle, spilled lift, tumbled sideways in a sickening drop, sealed the wing, and tugged handles and control bar while shifting my weight wildly to establish balance and control. The clouds had parted enough for me to see the cliff 20 or 30 meters to my right as I fought the thermals and the kite itself for a clean line. Then I was leveled and flying the contraption, spiraling around to my left again, but carefully this time, ever so carefully, thankful for the break in the clouds that allowed me to judge my distance from the cliff and leaning hard left on the control bar. Suddenly, a whisper in my ear said, "Wow, that was fun to watch. Do it again." I jumped at the voice in my ear and then looked up and behind me. The bright yellow triangle of Aenea's para wing circled above me, the clouds close above it like a gray ceiling. "No thanks," I said, allowing the calm threads on the throat of my skin suit to pick up the sub-vocals. "I guess I'm through showing off." I glanced up at her again. "Why are you here? Where's Abetic?"
"We rendezvoused above the clouds. Didn't see you, and I came down to find you," Aenea said simply, her calm-threaded voice soft in my ear.
I felt a surge of nausea. More from the thought of her risking everything to do that than from the violent acrobatics of a moment earlier. "I'm all right," I said gruffly. "Just had to get the feel of the ridge lift."
"Yeah," said Aenea. "It's tricky. Why don't you follow me up?"
I did so, not allowing my pride to get in the way of survival. It was difficult to keep her yellow wing in sight with the shifting fog, but easier than flying blind near this cliff. She seemed to sense exactly where the rock wall was, cutting our circle within 5 meters of it, catching the strong center of the thermals there, but never coming too close or swinging too wide. Within minutes we came out of the clouds. I admit that the experience took my breath away. First a slow brightening, then a rush of sunlight, then rising above the cloud level like a swimmer emerging from a white sea. Then squinting into the bright light within the blinding freedom of blue sky and a seemingly infinite view on all sides. Only the highest peaks and ridgelines were visible above the ocean of clouds. Tai Shan gleaming cold and icy white so far to our east. Heng Shan about equidistant to the north. Our ridgeline from Zhou Kung rising like a razor's edge just above the tides of cloud running back to the west. Kunlun Ridge, a distant wall, running northwest to southeast, and far, far away, near the edge of the world, the brilliant summits of Chomo Lori, Mount Parnassus, Kangchung Junga, Mount Koya, Mount Calais, and others I could not identify from this angle. There was a glimmer of sunlight on something tall beyond distant Fari Ridge, and I thought this might be the Botala or the lesser Shivling. I quit gawking and turned my attention back to our attempt to gain altitude. Abetic circled close by and gave me a thumbs up. I returned the signal and looked up to see Lomo gesturing 50 meters above us.
"Close up! Keep your circles tight! Follow me!"
We did that, Aenea easily climbing to her wingman position behind Lomo, Abetic's blue kite circling across the climb circle from her,
and me bringing up the rear 15 meters below and 50 meters across the circle from the android. Lomo seemed to know exactly where the thermals were. Sometimes we circled farther back west, caught the lift, and opened our circles to move east again. Sometimes we seemed to circle without gaining altitude. But then I would look north to Heng Shan and sense that we had covered another several hundred meters upward. Slowly we climbed, and slowly we circled east, although Tai Shan must still have been 80 or 90 clicks away. It grew colder and harder to breathe. I sealed the last bit of osmosis mask and inhaled pure O2 as we climbed. The skin suit tightened around me, acting as a pressure suit and therm suit all in one. I could see Lomo shivering in his zygote chuba and heavy mittens. There was ice on Abetic's bare forearm, and still we circled and rose. The sky darkened and the view grew more unbelievable. Distant Nanda Devi in the southwest, Helgafell in the even more distant southeast, and Harney Peak far beyond the Shivling, all coming into sight above the curve of the planet. Finally, Lomo had had enough. A moment earlier, I had unsealed the clear osmosis mask on my hood to see how thick the air was, tried to inhale what felt like hard vacuum, and quickly resealed the membrane. I could not imagine how Lomo managed to breathe, think, and function at this altitude. Now he signaled us to keep circling higher on the thermal he had been working, gave us the ancient good luck sign of the circled thumb and forefinger, and then spilled the thin air out of his delta kite to drop away like a hurtling Thomas Hawk. Within seconds, the red delta was several thousand meters below us and swooping toward the ridgeline to the west. We continued circling and climbing, occasionally losing the lift for a moment, but then finding it again. We were being blown eastward by the lower edges of the jet stream, but we followed Lomo's final advice and resisted the temptation to turn toward our destination. We did not have enough altitude or tailwind yet to make the 80-kilometer voyage. Encountering the jet stream was like suddenly entering a whitewater rapids in a kayak. Ania's kite found the edge of it first, and I watched the yellow fabric vibrate as if in a powerful gale, then the aluminum superstructure flex wildly. Then Abetic and I were into it, and it was everything we could do to hold ourselves horizontal in the swinging harness behind the control bar and continue circling for altitude. "It's hard," came Ania's voice in my ear. "It wants to tear loose and head east." "We can't," I gasped, pulling the parawing into the headwind again and being thrown higher in one great vertical lift ride. "I know," came Ania's strained voice. I was 100 meters away and below her now, but I could see her small form wrestling with the control bar, her legs straight, her small feet pointed backward like a cliff diver's. I peered around. The brilliant sun was haloed by ice crystals. The ridge lines were almost invisible so far below. The summits of the highest peaks now clicks beneath us. "How is Abetic doing?" asked Ania. I twisted and strained to see. The android was circling above me. His eyes appeared to be closed, but I could see him making adjustments to the control bar. His blue flesh gleamed with frost. "All right, I think," I said. "Ania?"
"Yes?"
"Is there any chance of the PAX at Shivling or in orbit picking up our comm thread broadcasts?" The comm unit disky journal was in my pocket, but we had decided never to use it until it was time to call the ship. It would be ironic if we were captured or killed because of using these skin suit communicators.
"No chance," gasped Ania.
Even with the osmosis masks and the rebreather matrix woven into the skin suits, the air was thin and cold.
"The comm threads are very short range, half a click at most."
"Then stay close," I said, and concentrated on gaining a few hundred more meters before the almost silent hurricane that was buffeting me sent the kite screaming off to the east. Another few minutes, and we could no longer resist the powerful current in this river of air. The thermal did not lessen. It just seemed to die away completely. And then we were at the mercy of the jet stream.
"Let's go!" shouted Ania.
forgetting that her slightest whisper was audible in my ear patch. I could see A. Bettick open his eyes and give me a thumbs up. At the same instant, my own power wing peeled off the thermal and was swept away to the east. Even with the diminished sound, we seemed to be roaring through the air at a speed so incredible that it was audible. Aenea's yellow delta streaked east like a crossbow dart. A. Bettick's blue followed. I wrestled with the controls, realized that I did not have the strength to change course 1 degree, and simply held on while we rifled east and down in the pounding, flowing river of air. Tai Shan gleamed ahead of us, but we were losing altitude quickly now, and the mountain was still very far away. Kilometers beneath us, beneath the monsoon sea of white cloud tops, the greenish phosgene clouds of the acid world ocean churned away, unseen, but waiting. The Pax authorities in Tian Shan's system were confused. When Captain Womack and the Jibril received the strange pulsed alarm signal from the Pax enclave at Chivling, he tried hailing Cardinal Mustafa and the others, but received no answer. Within minutes he had dispatched a combat dropship with 2 dozen Pax Marines, including 3 medics. The Tightline report uplink was confusing. The conference room at their enclave Gompa was a gory mess. Human blood and viscera were splashed everywhere, but the only body remaining was that of the Grand Inquisitor, who had been crippled and blinded. They DNA-typed the largest arterial spray and found it to be that of Father Farrell. Other pools of blood reportedly belonged to Archbishop Breck and his aide LeBlanc. But no bodies, no cruciforms. The medics reported that Cardinal Mustafa was comatose, in deep shock and near death. They stabilized him as best they could, using only their field kits, and asked for orders. Should they let the Grand Inquisitor die and be resurrected, or get him to the dropship dock in the box and try to save him, knowing that it would be several days before he could regain consciousness and describe the attack? Or the medic could get him to life support, use drugs to bring the Cardinal out of the coma, and interrogate him within minutes, all the while with the patient under exquisite pain and on the verge of death. Womack ordered them to wait in tight-beamed Admiral Lampriere, the task force commander. Out in the Tian Shan system, many AUs distant, the 40-some ships that had come through the battle with Raphael were rescuing survivors from the terminally damaged Archangels and awaiting the arrival of the Papal Drone and the Technocore robot ship that would be putting the planet's population in suspended animation. Neither had arrived. Lampriere was closer, 4 light minutes away, and the tight beam would take that long to reach him and bring him up to speed. But Womack felt he had no other choice. He waited while his message burned out system. Aboard the flagship Rogwell, Lampriere found himself in a ticklish situation, with only minutes to decide about Mustafa. If he allowed the Grand Inquisitor to die, it was likely that a 2-day resurrection would be successful. The Cardinal would suffer little pain. But the cause of the attack, Shrike, Indigenes, the Aenea Monster's disciples, Ousters, might remain a mystery until then. Lampriere took 10 seconds to decide, but it was a 4-minute tight-beam delay out and back.
"Have the medic stabilize him,"
he tight-beamed Womack on the Jibril in orbit around the mountain planet.
"Get him to dropship life support. Bring him out of it, interrogate him. When we know enough, have the auto-surgeon give a prognosis. If it's faster to resurrect him, let him die."
"Aye, aye, sir," said Womack 4 minutes later, and passed word along to the Marines.
Meanwhile, the Marines were widening their search, using EMV reaction packs to search the vertical cliff sides around the phallus of Shiva. They deep-radared Ran So, the so-called Otter Lake, finding neither otters nor the bodies of the missing priests. There had been an honor guard of 12 Marines in the enclave with the Grand Inquisitor's party, plus the pilot of the dropship. But these men and women were also missing. Blood and viscera were found and DNA typed, most of the missing thus accounted for, but their bodies were not found.
"Shall we spread the search to the Winter Palace?"
questioned the Marine lieutenant in charge of the party. All of the Marines had specific orders not to disturb the locals, especially the Dalai Lama and his people, before the Technocore ship arrived to put the population asleep.
"Just a minute," said Womack.
He saw that Admiral Lompriere's monitor telltale was on. The comm disk key on his command web was also blinking. Jibril's intelligence officer, down in the sensor bubble.
Yes?
Captain, we've been visually monitoring the palace area. Something terrible has happened there.
What? Snapped Walmack.
It was not like any member of his crew to be so vague.
We missed it, sir, said the intel officer.
She was a young woman, but smart, Lompriere knew.
We were using the optics to check the area around the enclave, but look at this.
Walmack turned his head slightly to watch the hollow pit fill with an image, knowing that it was being tight-beamed out to the admiral. The east side of the Winter Palace, Potala, as if seen from a few hundred meters above the Kiichu Bridge. The roadway of the bridge was gone, retracted. But on the steps and terraces between the palace and the bridge, and on some of the narrow ledges in the chasm between the palace and the Daeprung Monastery on the east side, were scores of bodies, hundreds of bodies, bloodied and dismembered.
Dear Lord, said Captain Walmack and crossed himself.
We've identified the head of Regent Tok'ra Redding there among the body parts, came the intel officer's calm voice.
The head? Repeated Walmack,
realizing that his useless remark was being sent to the admiral along with all the rest of this transmission. In 4 minutes, Admiral Lompriere would know that Walmack made stupid comments. No matter.
Anyone else important there?
He queried intel.
Negative, sir, came the young officer's voice. But they're broadcasting on various radio frequencies now.
Walmack raised an eyebrow. So far, the Winter Palace had maintained radio and tight-beam silence.
What are they saying?
It's in Mandarin and post-Hegira Tibetan, sir, said the officer. But then quickly. They're in a panic, Captain. The Dalai Lama is missing. So is the head of the Boy Lama's security team. General Sirkang Siwon Chempo, leader of the palace guard, is dead, sir. They've confirmed that his headless body was found there.
Walmack glanced at the clock. The tight-beam broadcast was halfway to the admiral's ship.
Who did this intel? The Shrike?
Don't know, sir. As I said, the lenses and cameras were elsewhere. We'll check the disks.
Do that, said Walmack.
He could not wait any longer. He tight-beamed the marine lieutenant.
Get to the palace, Lieutenant. See what the hell is going on. I'm sending down 5 more dropships, combat EMVs, and a Thopter gunship. Search for any sign of Archbishop Breck, Father Farrell, or Father LeBlanc. And the pilot and honor guard, of course.
Aye, aye, sir.
The tight beam link went green. The admiral was receiving the latest transmission. Too late to wait for his command. Walmack tight-beamed the 2 closest packed ships, torch ships just beyond the outer moon, and ordered them on battle alert and to drop into matching orbit with the Jibril. He might need the firepower. Walmack had seen the Shrike's work before, and the thought of that creature suddenly appearing on his ship made his skin go cold. He tight-beamed Captain Samuels on the torch ship HHS St. Bonaventure.
Carol, he said to the startled captain's image. Go tactical space, please.
Walmack jacked in and was standing in place above the gleaming cloud planet of Tian Shan. Samuels suddenly appeared next to him in the starry darkness.
Carol, said Walmack, something's going on down there. I think the Shrike may be loose again. If you suddenly lose transmission data from the Jibril or we start screaming gibberish.
I launch 3 boats of Marines, said Samuels.
Negative, said Walmack. Slag the Jibril immediately.
Captain Samuels blinked. So did the floating telltale that showed that Admiral Lompriere's flagship was tight-beaming. Walmack jacked out of tactical. The message was short.
I've spun the Raguil up for a jump in-system to just beyond the critical gravity well around Tian Shan, said Admiral Lompriere, his thin face grave.
Walmack opened his mouth to protest to his superior, realized that a tight-beamed protest would arrive almost 3 minutes after the Hawking Drive jump was executed, and shut his mouth. A jump in-system like this was sickeningly dangerous, one chance in 4 at least of a disaster that would claim all hands. But he understood the admiral's need to get to where the information was fresh and his commands could be executed immediately.
Dear Jesus, thought Walmack. the Grand Inquisitor crippled, the Archbishop and the others missing, the sodding Dalai Lama's palace looking like an anthill that's been kicked over. God damn that shrike thing. Where's the papal courier probe with its command? Where's that core ship we were promised? How can things get worse than this?
Captain?
It was the chief marine medic on the expeditionary force, beaming from the dropship infirmary.
Report.
Cardinal Mustafa is conscious, sir. Still blind, of course, in terrible pain, but...
Put him on, snapped Walmack.
A terrible visage filled the hollow sphere. Captain Walmack sensed others on the bridge shrinking back. The Grand Inquisitor's face was still bloodied. His teeth were bright red as he screamed. His eye sockets were ragged and void, except for tendrils of torn tissue and rivulets of blood. At first, Captain Walmack could not discern the word from the shriek. But then he realized what the Cardinal was screaming.
Nemes! Nemes! Nemes!
The constructs called Nemes, Scylla, and Briareus continue eastward. The three remain phase-shifted, oblivious to the staggering amounts of energy this consumes. The energy is sent from elsewhere. It is not their worry. All of their existence has led to this hour. After the timeless interlude of slaughter under the Pargo-Kaling Western Gate, Nemes leads the way up the tower and across the great metal cables holding the suspension bridge in place. The three jog through Drepung Marketplace, three motile figures moving through thickened amber air, past human forms frozen in place. At Fari Marketplace, the thousands of shopping, browsing, laughing, arguing, jostling human statues make Nemes smile her thin-lipped smile. She could decapitate all of them, and they would have had no warning of their destruction. But she has an objective. At the Fari Ridge cableway juncture, the three shift down. Friction on the cable would be a problem otherwise. Scylla, the northern highway. Nemes sends on the common band. Briareus, the middle bridge. I will take the cableway. Her siblings nod, shimmer and are gone. The cablemaster steps forward to protest Nemes's shoving in line ahead of scores of waiting cable passengers. It is a busy time of day. Radamanth Nemes picks the cablemaster up and flings him off the platform. A dozen angry men and women shove toward her, shouting, bent on revenge. Nemes leaps from the platform and grabs the cable. She has no pulley, no brakes, no climbing harness. She phase shifts only the palms of her inhuman hands and hurtles down the cable toward Kunlun Ridge. The angry mob behind her clip onto the cable and give chase, a dozen, two dozen more. The cablemaster had been liked by many. It takes Nemes half the usual transit time to cover the great abyss between Fari and Kunlun ridges. She breaks sloppily on the approach and slams into the rock, phase-shifting at the last instant. Pulling herself out of the crumbling indentation on the cliff behind the landing ledge, she walks back to the cable. Pulleys whine as the first of her pursuers careen down the last few hundred meters of wire. More spread out to the horizon, black beads on a thin string. Nemes smiles, phase shifts both her hands, reaches high, and severs the cable. She is surprised how few of the dozens of doomed men and women scream as they slide off the twisting, falling cable to their deaths. Nemes jogs to the fixed ropes, climbs them freehand, and cuts all of them loose. Ascent lines, rappel lines, safety lines, everything. Five armed members of the Kunlun Constabulary from Si Huang Mu confront her on the ridgeline just south of the slideway. She phase-shifts only her left forearm and swats them off into space. Looking northwest, Nemes adjusts her infrared and telescopic vision and zooms in on the great swinging bonsai bamboo bridge connecting the highway promontories between Fari Ridge and Kunlun Ridge. The bridge falls as she watches, the slats and vines and support cables writhing as they fall back to the western ridgeline, the lower reaches of the bridge dropping into phosgene clouds.
"That's that," sends Briareus.
"How many on it when it fell?" queries Nemes.
"Many,"
Briareus disconnects. A second later, Scylla logs on. Northern bridge down. I'm destroying the highway as I go.
Good, sends Nemes. I'll see you in Jokum.
The three shift down as they pass through the city fissure at Jokum. It is raining lightly, the clouds as thick as summer fog. Nemes's thin hair is plastered to her forehead, and she notices that Scylla and Briareus have the same look. The crowd parts for them. The ledge road to the temple hanging in air is empty. Nemes is leading as they approach the final short swinging bridge before the ledge below the stairway to the temple. This had been the first artifact repaired by Aenea, a simple 20-meter swinging span above a narrow fissure between dolomite spires 1,000 meters above the lower crags and cloud tops. And now the monsoon clouds billow beneath and around the dripping structure. Invisible in the thick clouds, something stands on the cliff ledge at the other side of the bridge. Nemes shifts to thermal imaging and smiles when she sees that the tall shape radiates no heat whatsoever. She pings it with her forehead-generated radar and studies the image. 3 meters tall, thorns, bladed fingers on 4 oversized hands, a perfectly radar-reflective carapace, sharp blades on chest and forehead, no respiration, razor wire rising from the shoulders and spikes from the forehead.
Perfect, sends Nemes.
Perfect, agrees Scylla and Briareus. The figure at the other end of the dripping bridge makes no response. We made it to the mountain with only a few meters to spare. Once we dropped out of the lower reaches of the jet stream, our descent was steady and irreversible. There were few thermals out above the cloud ocean and many downdrafts. And while we made the first half of the 100-click gap in a few minutes of thrilling acceleration, the second half was all heart-stopping descent. Now certain that we would make it with room to spare, now more certain that we would drop into the clouds and never even see our deaths rising to surround us until the kite wings struck acid sea. We did descend into the clouds, but these were the monsoon clouds, the water vapor clouds, the breathable clouds. The three of us flew as close as we could, blue delta, yellow delta, green delta. The metal and fabric of our para-wings almost touching, more fearful of losing one another and dying alone than of striking one another and falling together. Aenea and I had the comm threads, but we talked to each other just once during that suspenseful descent to the east. The fog had thickened. I caught the merest glimpses of her yellow wing to my left, and I was thinking, she had a child. She married someone else. She loved someone else. When I heard her voice on the hear patch of my suit. Rawl?
Yes, kiddo.
I love you, Rawl. I hesitated a few heartbeats, but the emotional vacuum that had pulled me a moment earlier was swept away in the surge of affection for my young friend and lover. I love you, Aenea. We swept lower through the murk. I thought that I could taste an acrid scent on the wind, the fringes of the phosgene clouds.
Kiddo?
Yes, Rawl? Her voice was a whisper in my ears. We had both removed our osmosis masks, I knew, although they would have protected us from the phosgene. We did not know if Abetic could breathe the poison. If he could not, the unspoken plan between Aenea and me was to close our masks and hope that we could reach the edges of the mountain before we struck the acid sea, dragging the android up the slope and out of the poison air if we could. We both knew that it was a flimsy plan. The radar aboard the ship during my initial descent had shown me that most of the peaks and ridges dropped abruptly beneath the phosgene cloud layer, and it would only be a matter of minutes between entering the poisonous clouds before we struck the sea anyway. But it was better to have a plan than to surrender to fate. In the meantime, we both had our masks up, breathing fresh air while we could.
Kiddo,
I said, if you know that this isn't going to work, if you've seen what you think is...
my death?
She completed the sentence for me. I could not have said it aloud. I nodded stupidly. She could not see me through the clouds between us.
They're only possibilities, Rawl, she said softly.
although the one I know of with the greatest probability is not this. Don't worry, I wouldn't have asked you both to go with me if I thought this was it. I heard the humor in her voice through the tension. I know, I said, glad that A. Bedick could not pick up this conversation. I wasn't thinking of that. I had been thinking that perhaps she had known that the android and I would make it to the mountain, but she would not. I did not believe that now. As long as my fate was entwined with hers, I could accept about anything. I was just wondering why we were running again, kiddo, I said. I'm sick of running away from the packs. So am I, said Anea. And trust me, Rawl, that's not all we're doing here. Oh, shit. Hardly the quotable pronouncement from a messiah, but in a second I saw the reason for her shout. A rocky hillside had appeared 20 meters ahead of us, large boulders visible between scree slopes, sheer cliffs lower down. A. Bedick led the way in, pulling up on his control bar at the last minute and dropping his legs from the stirrups of the rigging, using the kite like a parachute above him. He bounced twice on his boots and set the kite down quickly, snapping off his harness. Lomo had shown us many times that it was important on dangerous and windy landing sites to separate yourself from the parawing quickly, so that it did not drag you over some edge. And there was definitely an edge to be dragged over here. Anea landed next, me a few seconds later. I had the sloppiest of the three landings, bouncing high, dropping almost straight down, twisting my ankle on the small stones, and going to my knees while the parawing struck hard on a boulder above me, bending metal and rending fabric. The kite tried to tip over backward then, pulling me over the cliff's edge just as Lomo had warned. But A. Bedick grabbed the left struts, Anea seized the broken right spar a second later, and they stabilized it long enough for me to struggle out of my harness and hobble a few steps away from the wreckage, dragging my backpack with me. Anea knelt on the cold, wet rocks at my feet, loosening my boot and studying my ankle. "I don't think it's sprained badly," she said. "It may swell a bit, but you should be able to walk on it all right." "Good," I said stupidly, aware only of her bare hands on my bare ankle. Then I jumped a bit as she sprayed something cold from her med kit on the puffy flesh. They both helped me to my feet. We gathered our gear, and the three of us started arm in arm up the slick slope toward where the clouds glowed more brightly. We came up into the sunlight high on the sacred slopes of Tai Shan. I had pulled off the skin suit cowl and mask, but Anea suggested that I keep the suit on. I pulled my therm jacket on over it to feel less naked, and I noticed that my friend did the same. A. Bedick was rubbing his arms, and I saw that the high-altitude cold had left his flesh chilled almost white. "Are you all right?" I asked him. "Fine, Emendymion," said the android, "although another few minutes at that altitude..." I looked down at the clouds where we had folded the damaged kites and left them. "I guess we're not getting off this hill with the parawings." "Correct," said Anea. "Look." We had come out of the boulder fields and scree slopes to grassy highlands between great cliffs, the succulent meadows crisscrossed with zygote trails and stepping stone paths. Glacial melt streams trickled over rocks, but there were bridges made of stone slabs. A few distant herders had watched us impassively as we climbed higher. Now we had come around a switchback below the great ice fields and looked up at what could only be temples of white stone set on gray ramparts. The gleaming buildings,